At the start of the Science Show last week, I gave you a famous voice to identify. Lots did in seconds. So now, try this one.
Imagine night in Africa without electricity. A normal sundown for millions of African households. You want and need light for all sorts of reasons. Homework is just one. Your choice is invariably an early night or, if you can afford it, a kerosene lamp that will spew foul air, not to mention greenhouse gas.
Well, not hard. We shall reveal her name in 10 minutes when we talk about solar aid, which has just passed the magnificent total of 1 million solar lanterns brought to homes in Africa. Yes, a good news story for a change. Now here's another one. You've heard of the technology developed at the University of New South Wales to deploy old car tyres, the carbon from them, to the steel industry. Well, Professor Veena Sahajwala, who's won more gongs than Ian Thorpe for her brilliant work, tells me they've passed 1 million a while ago. Veena.
Well, do you believe it? We have actually crossed 1.8 million tyres already. So that's exciting, but we are reforming tyres and using that as a raw material in the process of making steel. So we are in fact injecting shredded tyres into electric arc furnaces and producing steel out of that. And we started doing that in Sydney a few years ago.
Congratulations, that's brilliant.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. It's so satisfying.
What about the follow-up using glass and bits of old metal as well from cars?
Yeah. Well, see, that was a nice thing for us. It started out with things like tyres. And of course, then we said, right, okay, now, you know, there's a whole lot of other stuff in cars and other things we throw around. So glass has got predominantly silica in it. So we thought, hang on, silica, we can reduce silica. And there's, guess what? Silicon to be had.
But you've got lots of silica in sand. Why do you need to recycle silica?
Because, I mean, the fact is that you can't just recycle all types of glass back as glass again. When you get to the more complex products, so, for example, in cars, we've got safety glass, which is our windscreen. These are all laminated glass products. And you can't just sort of go, right, we'll put it into a glass melting furnace, we'll make new glass out of it, because it's mixed with plastic. So what you've got to say is for really beautiful engineered products, like your safety glass, you need to think much more creatively. You have to be able to say, if I can't convert it into the same product again, what else can I do? And that's where our fourth R comes in. So reduce, reuse, recycle. And then the fourth R, which is what we're talking about, is reform. We actually want to think about reforming waste because we want to actually go beyond the conventional three R's.
Was it a challenge trying to get it done without using an awful lot of energy?
Well, you still have to have enough energy to actually reduce the silica. So it's an oxide of silicon. You still have to reduce that. But the beauty of what we do is we're actually producing an alloy. In this instance, we're talking about an iron and a silicon alloy called ferrosilicon. And the silicon actually dissolves into the iron, so it indeed converts directly into an alloy. So we're not going about producing silicon and then adding it to iron. We're saying, right, we've got iron oxide, we've got silicon dioxide. If we take the two together, we can indeed produce alloy in one step, which is the reason why we can actually do it at low temperatures. And of course, low temperatures means less energy.
Indeed. What is the hub that's just been announced that you're part of?
Yeah, look, I'm really excited about it. The hub is really all about green manufacturing. So we want to be able to transform waste directly in manufacturing processes. So the whole sort of notion of thinking about waste as a burden on the environment suddenly disappears. We can see it as a resource, and it's a valuable resource. So you go, right, okay, so there's glass, we talked about that. There's plastics, lots of plastics in cars. And if you could actually transform that and make value-added products, like building products, for example, out of that, you could then see this as a valuable source of raw materials. And that's indeed what the Green Manufacturing Hub is all about, Robin.
Who's in the hub?
Well, we've got industry partners, like we've got Brickworks. People might know Brickworks building product companies, and Arium, and we've got Tersim Energy, we've got Jalon. All of these guys, even though they might appear to be in completely different businesses, have got one common goal. They care about the environment. They care about the fact that there are waste resources that we simply throw away into landfill. And we're smarter than that. We can do so much better. So they share that vision with us.
Isn't there a resistance in industry? They want to do it the same old way rather than doing things, especially greenways. Greenways sound idealistic and impractical. Well, how have you found them?
These industry partners have been just amazing. Absolutely incredible people. They are also equally passionate about the environment. They want to be able to do the things that are within their power and within their control to make a difference. So we are talking about transformative science here, which is really saying, you know, let's go beyond the traditional recycling.
And there's more than one hub, isn't there?
Well, there are indeed. In this last round, the government announced 7 hubs, so we are one of the 7. And what the goal really is, from our point of view, which is so satisfying, is we can really bring together different industry sectors to partner with each other. So one industry sector might have a waste, which they might currently be putting away into landfill. Where we come into places, we go, right, okay, well, if there is this kind of way, so we can actually have this vision of some other manufacturer using it. Suddenly, these are different industries. One produces a ceramic product. The other produces a metal product. We're saying, you know, you guys have nothing in common other than the fact that this beautiful resource can join you two together. And that's where we come in.
Tell me, Veena, what is the secret of talking to people in business to be able to be practical, to get things done? What would you suggest to other engineers and scientists and, well, just lay people throughout the country?
You know, I think from my experience, what I find is that there is a little bit of a scientist in all of us. They don't have to get all of the science in the first conversation, but they can appreciate the impact of what the science can deliver through their businesses and to the world. And once you've got them hooked about the power of science and engineering and the ability to transform, I think businesses get hooked on. Of course, they've got to see the practical relevance for their business. They've got
Yes, but also there's a question of delivery dates,
yes.
You know, turnover, all the different things you have to take into account when you're out there in
yes.
the street in business.
Yes, the kinds of things that you're talking about is the KPTs, right? The key performance targets that we have to deliver. But it's like anything else in life. You set yourself a target. You have a vision for where you want to go. And important to share that vision with everyone. And they can understand that sometimes there will be challenges along the way, which I'm sure, let me tell you, there will be lots of them along the way. But I think people do appreciate that. That yes, there are times you can do your level best and you might still run into obstacles. And that's okay. That's what the journey is all about.
It is certainly, but not simply in Australia. You've been working with South Korea and
yes.
other countries. How's
yes.
that going?
That's really fantastic. Now, we have industry partners. You mentioned South Korea. So a name like Hyundai, for example, that people may have heard of. I mean, these types of organizations, again, are leaders in their own space. They innovate all the time and they appreciate what it means to their business. But at the same time, they appreciate the fact that engaging with university sector is also equally important. They don't want to just innovate in isolation and in their own silos. They want their engineers and scientists to also engage with university sector. And they've actually come to UNSW and they've set up a relationship with us.
Presumably with the tires, is it?
Well, I mean, the tires is one part of the story. And that, of course, is where our technology has now been commercially implemented. Late last year, we actually have now got our technology up and running in South Korea, which, again, to me, is so satisfying because you are showing to the rest of the world that it's Australian intellectual capacity that's of interest to technologically advanced countries like South Korea. You can't get a better tick of approval than that.
And which other countries?
Well, we've also been partnering with countries like Sweden and Finland. And I always love to think about my experiences of spending time out in Sweden. It just gets so incredibly cold. I know I'm stating the obvious, but it is a slight challenge for people like me to kind of be that close to the Arctic Circle. I mean, some of these industry partners we work with are within the distance of about 100 kilometers out of the Arctic Circle. So need I say more? These guys just have got their own challenges in terms of making the day-to-day practical things work. And for them to think about us right here at UNSW in Australia as the partners to work with. We've published papers with them and they've got the most incredibly brilliant scientists, young PhD students who come and spend time, you know, at the Smart Center with us. I think it's just such a privilege for us to be seen in that light.
Thank you, Veena. Congratulations.
Thank you, Robin. Thanks for having me.
Veena Sahajwala is director of the Centre for Sustainable Materials at the University of New South Wales, which has just been named as part of a new green hub with grants from the Australian Research Council worth $2.2 million. You may recall seeing Veena on The New Inventors as a judge on ABC television. Solar Aid is a charity led by Dr. Jeremy Leggett, the Solar King based in England, and they've just announced they've passed 1 million lanterns brought to poor villages in Africa. They provide 5% of the profits from Solar Century to fund the scheme. Sunny Money, it's called. Jeremy Leggett, between us we have a good old-fashioned kerosene lamp, which I remember fondly from the old days, giving off a nice kind of cottagey smell. Why is it the villain in your piece? What don't you like about it?
Lots of things, but two in particular. The first is it's a vampire on development. Across Africa, families spend anything up to 25%, a lot of them, of their annual income just on the kerosene for these lanterns. So if you can save them that, there's an awful lot you can do to foster development. And also, incredible as it seems, one of these little monsters puts up during its lifetime fully a ton of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So there's a really non-trivial greenhouse gas global warming component to this story. The other thing is that this is what you might think of as low-hanging fruit. We know we have to essentially get rid of fossil fuel burning by 2050 if we're going to keep global warming below manageable, potentially manageable levels. And therefore, you have to pick off uses of fossil fuel one by one. And amazing as it may seem, use of oil for lighting in the developing world is fully 3% of all oil use, including transport. So it's economic to get rid of that. That's what Solar Aid is intent on doing. We want to rid Africa of the kerosene lantern by 2020, 6 years from now.
And you just celebrated the selling of 1 million lanterns driven by solar. At what date was that reached?
This was a few weeks ago during the month of June. I don't mean to sound as I'm boasting about this, because this incredible achievement was done by the teams in Africa, and I'm just the chairman sitting in London. But in 4 years, we've sold 1 million solar lanterns, 650,000 of them in the last year, and we've become the number one retailer of solar lighting, or a retail brand. Sunny Money has become the number one retailer of solar lighting in Africa in just that short period, ahead of Total, the oil company. So I look at that achievement and I think to myself, we should be proud, and you know, we're on course. We have to sell, we reckon, 50 million solar lanterns by 2020 to lead the market, have 20% of the market that would eradicate the roughly 250 million that we would have to get rid of the whole lot. And I think to myself, come on, if we can do this, others can join this game. It's not that difficult.
How do you make them so cheaply?
We don't. We go to China and we look for the best Chinese technology at the moment, and we just go cheaper and cheaper and cheaper as the whole solar story is going. So we can sell an entry-level lantern for $8, and that is a cash proposition for people who are, you know, among the poorest people in the world. And we just pick the best kit and we carry the warranties and the guarantees back to back with the manufacturers. We're a sort of car phone warehouse of the development world.
I see. And how can it be the basis for a village economy? If you just sell them, how does it turn on the kind of enterprise of the local village?
Well, there's a school of thought that if you sell things affordably at ethical margins, people are going to value them more than if they're just given away. You can do a lot more than if they're just given away, because you can recycle the profits, and that's what we do. The enterprise is wholly owned by the charity, Solar Aid, and therefore Sunny Money profits are recycled constantly into the mission.
So you're not actually making a profit for your company, it's going straight back into the enterprise, the charity.
That's right. I think of this kind of company as a renaissance company. I mean, the charity was created with 5% of the profits of Solar Century, which is a totally different animal. This is a venture capital backed, red in tooth and claw creature of modern capitalism. But I did insist when the four sets of venture capitalists invested that, you know, we would be giving 5% of the profits to this Solar Aid thing, or else they weren't going to be allowed to invest in Solar Century. And I think there's a model there. If more companies did encourage that kind of use of their profits, why there's a lot more we could do to speed up improving the world.
Okay, let's go away from the profits and the development of the lanterns to the actual place where these people live. What is it about the kerosene in the kind of slums that they're occupying that is so pernicious?
Well, one just has to sit in a dark dwelling with a kerosene lantern burning and you see it and smell it straight away. First of all, the quality of the light is pitiful compared to what you can do with solar and a modern LED light. Second, the smell is noxious and, of course, deeply harmful to health in all sorts of ways.
Yes, it was suggested in the journal Science 2 years ago that 2 million people a year die from kerosene fumes?
This wouldn't surprise me. And the Lighting Africa program of the International Finance Corporation has got all sorts of horrible statistics like that. And then, of course, there's and kids drink the stuff. You know, that's non-trivial. You get toxicity cases in hospitals where kids pick up this bottle with a nice lemonade-looking substance in it and just drink it. And then there's the fire risk. A lot of these kerosene lanterns end up burning down the dwellings that people are living in and the schools as well. A lot of schools in Africa are boarding schools, and so if you get unsupervised use of this kind of lighting at night, there are horrible stories of fires in dormitories at schools.
There's a million sales, that's fine, but of course the population of Africa is gigantic, as is South America. How are you going to make sure that the numbers do increase on a scale that makes a difference?
Well, we know those numbers. We know that there are 110 million households in Africa that don't have electricity at all. And if they have any lighting, it's coming from kerosene. We know the numbers. If you take the projections of population growth and everything else out to the next 6 years, it's 250 million solar lanterns that we have to sell. And we can't sell all of them. I mean, that would be ridiculous and it wouldn't be a proper market. So we're figuring 20% would be a leadership role. We can sort of lead the market along. And the great thing that I think is so important about SolarAid and this company is that unlike a venture capital backed company, which would hide any advancement it had made in marketing or use of technology for fear its competitors would get to it, actually, we're going to share everything, and we do. So we're going to help the 80% of the market that needs to be created to get to the total eradication of the kerosene lantern in Africa by helping our competitors as well as ourselves.
How did Kate Blanchett help you in the beginning?
Oh, Kate was marvellous. She was our first patron for 3 years. She did a wonderful piece to camera about some of the things I've just said. And this, of course, helped us with starting up because you can't start something like this unless you have philanthropic money coming in. And we got that in quite considerable amounts from governments and aid agencies, from corporates, and of course from high net worth individuals and just ordinary people giving $5 here and $10 there. So Kate helped us with that in a crucial phase of the startup of the company.
Imagine night in Africa without electricity. A normal sundown for millions of African households. You want and need light for all sorts of reasons. Homework is just one. Your choice is invariably an early night or, if you can afford it, a kerosene lamp that will spew foul air, not to mention greenhouse gas. But what if your parents brought home a new device? A lantern charged by day with solar cells, which could beam pure, bright light all evening. And on top of that, a lantern that is made by the children from the local AIDS orphanage. SolarAid, a brand new charity, has begun by teaching those children to do just this. A small change from within, and a big, big reason for hope. At SolarAid, we want to make this hope grow. Please help us.
You said in the beginning that by 2050 you have to eliminate the use of fossil fuels. Surely that goal is unreachable, according to most of the experts?
Well, you know, the sensible money says that it's a dream, but most of the policymakers, in my experience, at and around the climate negotiations, know that is what they have to do. They have to set in train policies today that will get the world on the road to complete eradication of fossil fuels. And I think that if you look at the relative ease with which we are picking off this one use of oil across the piece, and then look at the next thing up the value chain in what you'd have to get rid of in fossil fuels, it is eminently doable. And if you look at the amazing cost down in solar, the reduction in manufacturing cost in solar over the last few years, some analysts are now calling it a terror dome for the fossil fuel users. Because if you plot it on the lifetime of a conventional fossil fuel project, be it an oil field or a power station, and then you just plot the cost down from 2006 to today, it's almost a vertical line, and it's beginning to intersect with oil use, as we've seen in kerosene, but also in LNG and other conventional uses of fossil fuels. So this is doable, and actually, I think the fossil fuel companies increasingly, I see it in their faces, they know now, they can see what's coming, and they smell their demise, and they've got a simple choice. They change their business models or they die. And this is the world I think we're living in, incredible as it may seem at this point in time.
Well, Andrew McKenzie, the new, well, newish chief executive of BHP Billiton, has said that whatever you might prefer, at least 70% of the fuels used or the sources of energy in the next few years in the developing countries, the poorer countries, will be of the fossil variety. Have you actually been to South America or Africa and seen recently the way in which the villages are maybe turning one way or the other?
Well, look, the answer to that is yes. And if you go to any, virtually any village in Africa and imagine how a coal-fired power plant or a large gas-fired power plant can help them, it can't. I mean, it's going to be far more expensive with all the wires and everything else than anything in solar. And what you see is the alternative rising. So in the same way as Africa missed out on telephony and went straight to the mobile, that's what's going to happen with solar. And we see it in our own experience in Solar Aid and Sunny Money. You know, with these savings that people make on their annual income, we know where that goes. It goes on seeds, it goes on books, it goes on things that improve their life. It also goes to buy the next model up the chain. So a bigger solar lantern that can light up the whole small household instead of just provide one point of light. So you see the way that the money is reinvested, and that's the model for development. I tell you, coal is not going to figure in that, and gas is not going to figure in that.
Dr. Jeremy Leggett chairs Solar Century in London and is also head of the charity Solar Aid. And the figure for their total lantern number is now 1,089,000. And by the way, an alternative view on the endurance of fossil fuels is given this week in Occam's Razor on RN at 7:45 on Sunday mornings and, of course, online. This is The Science Show, in which, for the past few weeks, we've brought you PhDs and other bright sparks from FameLab, the Australian finals of which were held in Fremantle. And now the international finals have been held in Cheltenham, as Paul Olding reports.
Every year since 2005, the UK's famous Cheltenham Science Festival has been home to the grand finals of FameLab. This is the X Factor of the science world, an international competition backed by the British Council to find and nurture young scientists and engineers with a flair for communicating with public audiences. This year was the first time Australia took part, and the first Australian FameLab national champion is Dr. Michael Smout. I caught up with him at the festival. FameLab is all about sort of science communication. Why did you want to get involved?
I really do enjoy spreading my love of science. I always like pushing myself. Presenting terrifies me, but trying to get myself better all the time with all the various public presentations. And, yeah, just spreading the word, trying to get more people in it and get more people enthused about science in general.
Michael is a medical researcher at James Cook University in Townsville and studies one of nature's more unpleasant creatures, an Asian parasitic liver worm that causes bile duct cancer. And what's the name of this worm that you study?
Opisthoccus viverrani, commonly known as the Thai liver worm.
And how does that get into me?
By eating raw fish or eating undercooked fish. In the northeast of Thailand, Laos and Cambodia is where it's mostly prevalent, and people have a tradition of fermenting these little freshwater carp. So don't worry, your sushi is safe.
So how did a researcher studying parasitic liver worms end up representing Australia in the FameLab International Finals?
Well, we had a state finals, so it involved a written abstract and then a 3-minute video, and then we got selected for the states. Then we had to prepare a 3-minute presentation with no electronic media, so it involved all props. And then there was a national finals in Perth, and then that then went through to Cheltenham Grand Finals in the world.
What was the Australian finals like in Perth?
Yeah, it was a whole lot of fun. We had a whole bunch of presentation training by one of the British Council trainers, and so that really allowed us to do a bunch of acting exercises and things just to think about the way our presentation went from A to B. Yeah, really allowed to really chopped it around, and it was able to have a lot more drama in it, I think. It certainly helped.
Arriving at the FameLab finals in Cheltenham, Michael was now competing against a lineup of national champions from across the globe. How many countries were represented, and what was it like talking and being with scientists from around the world?
It was just amazing. 25 countries, I think it was, and most of them without English as their first language, some of them even English as their third language. So it was just incredible to talk to so many people from everywhere. And it was really interesting, too, seeing the different range of presentation styles. Some people were more just calmly talking about either their work or the scientific principle, or some people like me had some crazier props and were a little bit manic on stage. And it's really interesting seeing how different people get across ideas.
For the grand finals, Michael had prepared a presentation on his liverworm research to be delivered in front of 3 judges and a live audience. With a cuddly teddy bear under his arm, he's introduced onto the stage by host Quentin Cooper.
Our first ever FameLab Australia winner, Dr. Michael Smout, is a Brisbane-raised, Cairns-based geek since the age of 6, who is now a parasitologist working with the Queensland Tropical Health Alliance. A very warm welcome, please, for the reigning Aussie FameLab champ, Michael Smout.
Who likes to travel? Who's been to Southeast Asia? You one of the 800,000 Britons who go to Thailand every year? Well, maybe you need to be a little bit more careful. If you've eaten raw fish, maybe you've brought home a friend. Teddy's been to Thailand. He loves to travel. He goes to all the remote places. He eats some raw fish. Unfortunately, he brought home a friend as well. But luckily, I'm a doctor. I can help. This is Teddy's liver. Teddy brought home Larry the Liverworm. Now, unfortunately, the ones we can catch aren't quite as cute. They're about the shape of a leaf and the size of half a matchstick, and you can get hundreds if you eat a lot.
So take me through the moment you stepped out on stage.
Oh, you walk out there, you've got the little radio mic like you're some pop singer, and there's big spotlights on you. You can't actually see much of the crowd at all. I got a little giggle from the crowd as I gave Teddy a pat on the head. And yeah, the adrenaline pumping through my system, but I've been practicing this talk for about a month now, so it was pretty ingrained. Yeah, then just I go into the zone and do my bit.
What's the problem with getting a liver worm? Well, it's munching around your liver, causing wounds, then healing them up, causing wounds, healing them up. Now, in the short term, this is great. It wants you to be nice and healthy. It's going to live for decades. But over the long term, over the decades, it eventually can cause damage. And that eventually can lead to liver cancer. This particular type is deadly and kills within a year. As a tourist, it's not particularly a problem because you can take a pill, that'll get rid of it. But where it is a problem is for the local Thais who have this disease, and 20,000 of them die every year. So we're working to use this growth factor to create a vaccine to help these poor impoverished Thais. But what does this mean for those of us not infected with the worm? Well, by understanding this growth factor, we believe we'll be able to supercharge our wound healing. It won't give us Wolverine-like superpowers, but it may create super bandages.
I was intrigued to know more about how the spit of this liverworm might be used to help wound healing.
Well, we're not absolutely certain, but what we think is that it's living in you for a decade, so it wants to keep you nice and healthy. So it's munching around your liver, and we think it's zipping up the wounds it's causing as it goes along, trying to keep you in the best state that you can be.
And it's that molecule that you think you can use for a different purpose?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the granulin molecule that the worm spits out, and that's actually very similar to what we use for our wound healing. And so we think by short-circuiting that pathway, we'll be able to override it and be able to improve wound healing in some situations.
Back on stage, Michael comes to the end of his 3 minutes in the spotlight.
So to summarise, don't eat raw fish in Thailand, worm spit causes cancer, and magical bandages may be just around the corner. Thank you.
Sadly, Michael didn't win the competition. The crown ultimately went to a chap called Patrick Flood from the Netherlands for his presentation on improving photosynthesis to prevent food scarcity. But Michael clearly feels the whole experience was well worth it. And if there were any science researchers out there sort of contemplating maybe next year's Fame Lab, what would you say to them?
Absolutely, give it a red hot go because it's a whole lot of fun and you might have a chance to come over to the UK to represent Australia and compete in the finals.
Dr. Michael Smout from James Cook University in Cairns, and as you heard from reporter Paul Olding, the winner talked about photosynthesis.
So Patrick Flood is the reason why. Not only did he win the sole multinational competition, Fame Lab Benelux, which, as the name implies, spans Belgium, the Netherlands and Luxembourg, he's also Irish. And since there's nobody else from Ireland in the final, I guess they'll be rooting for him too. So Patrick is currently finishing his PhD at Wageningen University in the Netherlands. Do love saying that. Looking at how to use plant genetics and natural variation to make various crops easier to grow and tastier. And when he's not doing this at the lab, he's doing his own private field work as he loves eating wild plants whenever and wherever he can find them. So win or lose, you may find him later snacking in the hedgerows and flower beds of Cheltenham, but not until we Benny luxuriate in 3 minutes of Patrick Flood.
Imagine you were inside a leaf. It's a sunny day, and the cells around you are glowing with the soft green light. You move into one of these cells, and you see that this green glow is coming from melon-shaped objects called chloroplasts. As you look closer, you see tiny antennae harvesting this light and channeling it down to a reaction center. It is at this point that light becomes life. This process is known as photosynthesis. Literally building with light. It is the fundament of all life on Earth. The energy I am using to talk to you right now, the air we are breathing, and even the fossil fuels that power our economy all come from photosynthesis. I'm telling you this because our population looks set to reach 9 to 10 billion by 2050. This is a massive increase in the number of people that need to be fed, and it is way beyond our current capacity to produce food. But believe it or not, we have faced such a challenge before. In the 1950s, the world's population reached 2.5 billion. And for many experts, further sustainable growth seemed an impossibility. They predicted massive famines and the collapse of our civilization and referred to it as the population bomb. But thankfully, some scientists did not give up. They had a vision, and collectively they brought about an agricultural transformation like nothing we have ever seen before. They quadrupled yields in a matter of years in what became known as the Green Revolution. The man who spearheaded this was Nobel Prize winner Norman Borlaug, who was credited with saving more lives than any other individual in the history of our species. His work was so incredibly successful that in the developed world we went from potential food shortage to food mountains. But this is no longer the case. The population time bomb has not stopped ticking, and that is where photosynthesis comes in. The scientists of the Green Revolution did an amazing job at increasing crop productivity, but they never managed to improve photosynthesis. In fact, some scientists still say that it can't be done. But already, from my own research, I say otherwise. There is a resource out there, a resource which is the fuel of evolution and which we can tap into. This resource is genetic variation. In the case of photosynthesis, this variation manifests as differences in the efficiency at which plants convert light to life. The genetic basis of these differences can be used to create plants which will feed and fuel our future. We must increase the productivity of our crops so that we can buy the world time to reach a point of population stability. In the words of Norman Borlaug, you can't build a peaceful world on empty stomachs and human misery. We need a second green revolution. And photosynthesis is one key which cannot be left unturned.
Parik Flood, winner of FameLab, the international competition. And our thanks to the Cheltenham Science Festival for help with those recordings, and to Paul Olding, who was there for the science show. Photosynthesis, making plants, making trees out of thin air. And the sandalwood tree is one that's being investigated by Dr. Liz Barber at the University of Western Australia to find the genes behind the fragrant oil for which sandalwood is renowned. But the story is both exciting and dark.
Well, it can grow to about 15 metres high. And I would say the greatest similarity in your mind maybe with an apple tree. But it's not a striking tree at all. And normally what is more striking when you look at the plantations, because it's a parasitic plant.
So it's right next to the tree on which it's parasitic?
Oh, very much so. Certainly the younger it is, the more reliant it is upon that sort of protection. As it grows older and it becomes more structured, and of course its root system has expanded out and can actually attach onto many other plants, the distance can grow greater.
It's amazing that a tree with such a reputation, you know, for that sexy oil, the perfume, should in fact be so sinister.
Sinister?
Well, being a parasite, you know, taking over other trees and killing them.
Well, I think it's actually very clever because, you know, of course we haven't got very nutritious soils, so it takes advantage of absolutely everything. And I think what's also really interesting, you know, in actually dealing with it, because we have, you know, the Indian sandalwood that grows right up in the north. We have the native, what we call our native Australian sandalwood, which is Santalum spicatum, which actually grows down in the southwest. So same genus, completely, utterly different environments in terms of rainfall, whereas the sandalwood up north needs almost, it has irrigation up there. It's 800 mils rainfall, but it couldn't survive without the additional irrigation. Whereas you've got sandalwood surviving down in the southwest in the goldfields, you know, on 200 mils a year. Just the contrast of it and the soil types and the nutrition and everything that it survives in. It's an amazing tree, it really is.
Do ours in Australia produce the oil and the perfume as well as the other species, the Indians that you mentioned? Because, I mean, that perfume, pirates and people used to kill for it.
Yeah, the spicatum, the native, the Australian sandalwood, does produce a really good oil, which is actually very commercially sought after. The one thing that actually just slightly changes is that it has what's called farnesyl in it, which some people class as an irritant. And it's a funny thing because there's some trees that have a high proportion of it and other trees that have no farnesyl, within the spicatum, have no farnesyl at all. Whereas when you get to Santalum album, you don't get that farnesyl at all. It's a very constant profile, and that's why it's actually preferred, because it's such a constant oil profile.
What have you done to find the genes responsible for that oil?
Well, it was a wonderful story. We had a wonderful student, Chris Jones, and we actually realised it's a very, very simple system there. Basically, we hypothesised it was a two-gene process. So then we went out to actually prove it, and it was the most exciting thing when we found the first gene and we actually put it back into the E. coli system to express it, and it came out exactly with the four components that it was meant to and exactly the proportions that we actually predicted. It was just like, I can't tell you the excitement of it. It was just amazing, you know, to actually see that you had it bang on and it was right. We've just recently found the second one, which was actually really, really hard to find. And we had a lovely person in Canada. We've actually made a really strong relationship with UBC.
University of British Columbia Vancouver.
Yes, University of British Columbia. So we've actually had a wonderful exchange with them. We've been going backwards and forwards between them. They're just actually out here at the moment because we're doing some more work. But it's just been really well. Anyway, we've discovered the last one. So we've actually found the two major genes that actually produce all the main components, that's sort of about 80% of the oil. But there's still things, you know, everybody says to me, oh, now you've found the genes, it's going to be all very scary, you know, you can put them in anything and whatever. But we're still discovering all that, exactly what makes that very unique smell. If you get a real expert, you can put spicatum oil, album, which is the Indian sandalwood, spicatum's the Australian one, you can put the other ones, Astra caledonicum, you can put, you know, all the other species, and they can pick up exactly which ones they are, because they've actually got very definite aromas to each of them. So we're still trying to discover what all the different components actually add up to and contribute to that overall smell of the whole plant.
So you can't actually put it in a gigantic vat and get those E. coli bacteria you mentioned churning it out by the, what, hundreds of litres?
It can happen, very much so. But it still will be different. And it actually will go into a different market because, you know, when we were doing this, of course, we had to look and see, you know, what it was all about.
Why is it so sexy? Why has it got a reputation, that perfume, for being so, well, erotic?
Do you know the smell well? Do you know it? It's just the most calming, just very soporific. It just has this, I don't know what it is about it. And it works, you know, you can actually see, because it doesn't have a note to it. It's very base. You know, that's what it's used in the perfumes, is that base note in perfumes. And then they lift it, you know, with other sort of aromas that actually come in.
Yeah, soaps, candles, all sorts of things. The industry must be worth quite a lot of money.
Yes, it is, but you need to be careful because there's a lot of synthetics that are actually on the market, the shops, and they say they're sandalwood. And I smell them. They're not sandalwood at all. And actually that's become quite a concern to us, is that if there's so many of these synthetics actually coming in that claim they're sandalwood, is that people in the end are not actually going to know what sandalwood really smells like. So the industry are very concerned about it, and hence the need to almost have this as a backup, because, as you know, sandalwood has been ravaged by disease in India. Of course, there's been a lot of stealing of it. We've had a court case here where people... So it, because it's in such demand and there is such a high price, it has been overutilized tremendously. So, you know, the native populations are suffering some really dire consequences. I mean, even on some islands in Fiji, they introduced... The rats are eating all the seeds, so there's no regeneration. So there's all sorts of things that have actually impacted on the genus all over the Pacific region. You know, whilst everybody say, yes, we have overexploited, yes, everybody wants it, we need to do a lot more work in terms of meeting the demand in a way that still preserves the natural populations. So that's actually what we're trying to do. So this is what we hope will actually help preserve some of those natural populations so that we have them in the future.
Dr. Liz Barber is at the University of Western Australia leading the sandalwood research, producing results for the industry and conservation. The Science Show on RN. Back in the middle of May, we had a whole science show on citizen science, a revolution happening around the world, enlisting you to help the professionals in any number of fields. Here's another example, based in Melbourne.
Hi, my name is Dr. Lyndon Ashcroft, and I'm the Program Manager of Climate Watch at Earthwatch Australia. You may have noticed the trees in your local area slowly losing their leaves recently as autumn turned to winter. Or perhaps the wattle tree in your backyard started flowering, a pretty sure sign that winter is here. But how does the timing of this year's natural calendar compare to last year's, or the year before that, or even further back? Studying the seasonal behaviour of plants, birds, insects and other animals is called phenology. Phenologists explore how climate can cause changes to things like flowering, breeding or migration dates. The impact of temperature and rainfall changes on crop yield and biodiversity means that phenology is playing an increasingly big role in climate research. We don't just need the instrumental weather observations of temperature and rainfall, but also the records that plants and animals are supplying to us about how the changes are affecting them. Common brown butterflies, for example, are appearing 10 days earlier in Melbourne than they were in the 1940s. Migrating birds are arriving in the southern hemisphere about 2 days earlier each decade than they were in the 1970s, while the date of the first flower in spring has moved by almost 1 day per year for many species. While I know it sounds lovely to have flowers earlier in the year, these changes can lead to crucial relationships breaking down within ecosystems. For example, birds often time their breeding to coincide with the peak of their food supply, whether that is bugs or nectar. Bird breeding is occurring earlier than it used to, but insects and flowers are appearing even earlier, and this causes an increasing gap between the chick hatch and the peak food supply. This can cause a drop in chick survival and damage the bird population. To understand these on-the-ground impacts of warmer temperatures requires regular observations from lots of different locations. As much as I'd like to, I can't be everywhere to record the date of the first jacaranda flower or the first red-necked stint that returns to Australian shores after their migration to Alaska. For this reason, scientists are turning to you, citizen scientists. Citizen science is a growing field, connecting the public with researchers to answer great scientific questions. In the case of Australian phenology, this means calling on you to record what is happening in the local park, at school, or even in your own backyard. I bet you do notice these things, whether you mean to or not. A lot of people come up to me and say, "Oh yeah, my jacaranda has flowered early this year," or "I saw this really weird bird that I've never seen before." All we're asking you to do for our Climate Watch program is to take a photo of these things that you notice and submit them for science. Climate Watch is Australia's national citizen science phenology program. It was established in 2009 by Earthwatch Australia with the Bureau of Meteorology and the University of Melbourne. The aim of the program is to improve understanding of the impact of temperature and rainfall changes on Australia's plants and animals. There are over 170 indicator species that Climate Watch is looking out for, including 45 birds, over 40 different plant species, 30 marine critters, insects, mammals, and reptiles. Some species are really easy to spot, like the mighty English oak, while others, such as the endangered swift parrot, are harder to find. Since 2009, Climate Watch has recruited over 13,000 people who have submitted more than 60,000 observations. The program is currently being used by 9 universities across Australia to teach biology, and there are more than 40 self-guided walking trails set up at botanic gardens, local parks, and environmental education centres. Species experts from universities and museums provide support to assess the data quality, and the observations then become publicly available through the Atlas of Living Australia, which is the national biodiversity database. The key to a successful monitoring program like Climate Watch is reliable observers and long-term observations. Similar programs in the US and the UK have been running for decades thanks to long-term support. While Climate Watch is still in its early stages compared to these international programs, the Australian data are already indicating some changes. Earlier flowering dates have been recorded for several plant species, and tropical species such as the invasive Asian house gecko have been spotted further and further south. The predicted El Niño conditions for this summer mean that a warm and dry spring is probably likely, bringing with it confused plants and animals. So please, keep a lookout and record what you see. It's free to register, and you can record online or through the Climate Watch smartphone app. Earthwatch is a non-for-profit organisation, and we rely on donations and partnerships to keep our programs running. You can donate to Climate Watch and find more information at our website, climatewatch.org.au.
And that link will also be on our Science Show website, Lyndon Ashcroft in Melbourne. So, citizen science is one big change well underway in science. Another in research is bringing one discipline to fetch new ideas to another, like astrophysicist Paul Davis switching to cancer research. Simon Taveray in Cambridge is a mathematician who's also turned to cancer with intriguing results.
Actually, it's now old enough not to be a trend, although I have to say that a lot of people imagine it's a new area, thinking about evolution and cancer in the same breath. It's been around for at least 50 years as a field. It's now much more encouraging than it used to be because we have the technology to measure things much better, be it microscopy or sequencing and things, techniques like that. And that's really the role where the mathematicians have to play, trying to understand the data on such huge scales as they produce now.
Last time I was here doing work with people concerned with genomes of tumours, it was very much to look at the ways in which you can find out what the tumour had as a vulnerability so that you could then have designer drugs rather than blunderbuss drugs. You know, instead of providing anti-cancer drugs and hoping, you were much more specific. Is that the line that you're taking in your institute?
Yes, but things have got more complicated recently with the acknowledgement of what is now called cancer heterogeneity or tumour heterogeneity. So to give a simple example, we've worked for a while on glioblastoma, one of the most unpleasant brain cancers. And it has the strange property that if you were to take a biopsy from your patient in several different places, the genetic content of those biopsies and the response to drugs look completely different in the different sections. And what we're trying to work out now is how you deal with that heterogeneity. So targeting with something with a single drug is arguably not going to work very well because you're going to miss some of the action in the tumour.
That seems terribly unfair. Brain cancer is unfair in the first place, but to have that range of variety in one set of tumours.
It turns out that it's reasonably common in many tumour types.
Is that because the tumours are changing so fast, because cancer is really biological chaos?
Well, what you might imagine is that if you came along with your separate drug, if the cells in the tumour were basically one clone, then your one drug, if it's effective at all, is likely to kill all of those cells. But if in fact the thing is made up of separate clones of different types, then your one drug is likely to hit some of the clones and leave other ones alone, and they will then look like the most interesting thing to the tumour, and they'll grow quicker and evade the effects of the chemo, for example, or radiotherapy. And that puts you back to square one again. So that's where it is thought many relapses come from.
How do you get around that?
So the current strategy is to try multiple chemo drugs at the same time. Of course, I'm not a doctor, so I don't have to actually do this in practice. But in principle, you could imagine trying to stage things that would attack particular types of clone that you had observed from big studies of tumours to notice that they were common in this particular type of tumour. And so you make sure you can deal with all of them. One of the difficulties, of course, is that you can't really watch, at least in my example of the brain tumour, you can't watch the evolution of the tumour because it's impractical. Pretty much, I think 10% of patients, if I remember the statistics correctly, have a chance of a second operation if they have glioblastoma. And after that, there's nothing you can do, really. So one of the interesting questions at the moment is how might you be able to measure something about a tumour without having to stick size 12 needles through people's chest walls and see what's going on?
And the answer is?
Well, one answer is to look at tumour cells or tumour DNA that circulate in your blood. And that seems to be a project which is going extremely well. We do some of that at our institute. And others around the world have realised this is a very interesting thing to do, particularly the circulating tumour DNA part. So if you were interested in the evolution of a tumour, you now just take a blood sample, you look at the plasma in that sample, and you measure the mutations in the cancer DNA in the blood. Now you realise what you've just done, you've got a way of watching the tumour by just taking blood samples.
Funnily enough, we have in the Science Show PhDs almost every week. And there's a young woman from the University of Sydney who was talking about prostate cancer in exactly that regard, where you're looking at 168 different proteins of the blood at one time and getting a far greater handle on whether the prostate cancer or the prostate tumour is a problem or not.
Yes, so the one issue here is you have to be able to determine ahead of time what is likely to be a problem and what isn't, so that you know what you're looking for. That's hard, because as you get more and more resolution, you find things are more and more subdivided in a sense. So it's a difficult problem.
And people forget, of course, there are so many different sorts of cancer, you know, thousands, hundreds certainly, and it's not just one lump.
That's true, and some people are unlucky enough to get several completely independent ones of different types. Some people get metastases, many do, that's usually what you die from. Yes, it's a complicated disease, but I suppose one thing we have to be careful about is imagining that all these new looking ways of thinking of things are necessarily going to rush us to a new solution. I think that's hopeful at best.
What's the most hopeful line at the moment?
So one of the key things in all this, of course, is early detection. That's been one of the things which has really helped to decrease the apparent incidence of many tumour types. Breast cancer is now much less the really unpleasant tumour type that it was even 25 years ago. So that sort of advance is changing things dramatically. As ever, it's driven by technology, in a sense. Technology and a few good ideas.
Many coming from maths. Simon Tavare is director of the Cancer Research UK Cambridge Institute. And perhaps you know the name Tavare if you follow cricket, because his cousin was in cricket, one of England's slowest openers. Next week on The Science Show, the 400th anniversary of the logarithm and the quest to save the Lord Howe stick insect. And on Catalyst, back at last, tattoos, mining on the moon and making mussels out of fishing lines. That's Thursday at 8 on ABC Television. Production today by David Fisher and Joe Wallace. I'm Robin Williams.
container vessels have some economies. Now, we believe that those economies should be shared between the ship owners and the shippers.
In 1970, Australia's Transport Minister couldn't have imagined that container shipping would transform every port and the lives of those who worked them, and also generate world trade and the rise of China. Join me, Keri Phillips, for Rear Vision and the story of container shipping. And you can download or stream this Rear Vision from the RN website.